Good morning. Welcome to Talking About California, our series of discussions with Californians who talk about their home state, California, and their lives and work here. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. This morning, our guest, I'm happy to say, is Professor Lauren Coodley. Professor Coodley is a teacher, a writer, an activist who lives not so very far away from here in Napa. There are lots of things that Professor Coodley is involved in, but the occasion this morning is the forthcoming publication of a new book on a very fascinating character. Professor Coodley has kind of become the go-to expert on this subject, but she's written about the writer Upton Sinclair. And so we're going to, I know she wants to talk about that and her book, and we're going to get there, but first of all, let me say good morning, Professor.
Hello.
Good morning, and I can call you Lauren?
Yes.
For the interview. Okay.
Of course.
And could you just maybe tell our listeners a little bit about your work and how you came to be interested in Upton Sinclair and his
sure.
world?
Absolutely. So I've been living here since the mid-70s when I was hired as a part-time teacher to work at the community college. And after about 20 years of teaching psychology, I decided I was more interested in history. So I got a second degree, a master's degree in history. And as I started teaching history, I realized that the California history class had been sort of gathering dust in the archives, so I revived the California history class in the 90s. And then I was looking for materials, and providentially, the fantastic film on the EPIC campaign called We Have a Plan, part of the PBS series on the Great Depression, got made right when I was looking for materials. So I showed it to my class. And the class was just so enraptured with this idea of fixing poverty in California. And I realized that I had never heard about it, that I, you know, had been educated in California, grew up here, didn't know anything about Upton Sinclair or the campaign. So I started with that. That was initially my my entry point into Upton Sinclair studies was the campaign.
Okay, but before that, I'm just looking at your resume here, and you have a couple of MAs from Sonoma State, is that right? History
yes.
and psychology?
Yes.
And an interested in women's history?
Yes.
I think you've done a few things there that you might mention before we get to the main point here.
So I wrote and taught the first course in women's history at the local community college. I'm still the only woman who has tenure who's ever taught history of any kind at that college. I developed women's history over 25 years into a two-semester course and obviously changed it and diversified it as the field expanded. Very heartbroken to say that I was not replaced and that there is no ongoing development of women's history at that college, although I know that it's still a thriving field at other institutions.
Not too bad.
So then I turned my attention to California and to Napa history. I created a course called Napa Vallejo History, which I taught while I was working. I retired a couple years ago.
I see. And what about Napa history? What drew you to that?
Well, I was invited to write a history of the town by Arcadia Publishing in the early 2000s, and I realized I'd been, you know, clipping things about the town since I moved there in the 70s. A lot of people who grew up here, you know, wrote columns in the local paper about their reminiscences, and I found those fascinating, so I had a little file on the history of the town, but I also had a lot to learn, so I wrote what is still the only full-length narrative history of the town of Napa in 2004 and revised it and re-edited it in 2007. It's called Napa, The Transformation of an American Town. I'm very proud of it. I'm really very, very proud of that book.
Well, give us a glimpse then. We can still buy that book, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. So what I learned from, you know, teaching history is that stories, lots of stories, get left out of the official narrative. So I wanted my book to be give voice to the people who normally get left out of history. So one of my friends, Greg Brecken, called it a people's history of Napa. That's one way of looking at it. It documents certain struggles that happened here, you know, anti-war, civil rights, anti-growth, those kinds of struggles. And there was a huge fight to preserve the agrarian life here, that is, the diversified agriculture that used to be here, where, you know, all kinds of fruit were grown, and prunes was the main crop. So that battle was lost. Some were, you know, some battles were lost, some were won. I also chronicled the battles of unionized workers here in Napa, and Napa was a completely unionized town here in by 1940, and now is almost completely non-union except for public employees. So my book, you know, followed the thread of those developments. That's what I think is really unique about it.
Okay, and so that's called Napa, The Transformation of an American Town, right?
Yeah, and of course I tried to make it, you know, weave women's history into it, make it multicultural, you know, to some extent I was able to do that. I think in my subsequent books on Napa, they became more multicultural as Napa's become more diverse in the last 10 years than it used to be.
Okay, and that's Arcadia Publishing.
Yes. So as I said, I've written two other books about Napa since then.
Okay, well, and before, again, I'm going to hold off on the main subject. I was looking through some of the material that you sent me, Lauren, and this caught my eye, so let me ask you about this. A children's fantasy about saving the redwoods in the 1930s. Now, there's something dear to my heart, but... What was that?
Well, you realize that was Upton Sinclair, right?
Oh, it's you. No, I've misread it. Oh,
yeah.
Right. He wrote it.
Yeah. Okay. The Gnomobile.
All right. Well, maybe since we're there, let's get to Upton Sinclair for now. I'm sorry about that. Can you bring that back to your thoughts?
Particular book, yeah.
Yeah, interest in the redwoods.
I paid a lot more attention to that book than other biographers have because I used to teach children's literature, and I'm very interested in the field, and I'm particularly interested in environmental children's literature as a kind of subfield, like The Lorax and other books that raise children's awareness about the environmental problems. So I was quite struck that Upton Sinclair in 1936 had written what I, you know, argue is one of the earliest children's books with an environmentalist message. He based it on the trip that he took with his wife to raise money after the failure of the Epic campaign. He had never been to Northern California. They drove through the redwoods about, like I said, about 35, 36. And he was struck by their beauty, and he also knew they were threatened. So he set this story up where these two children are driving through the redwoods with their wealthy grandfather and in a Model T, and little gnomes come out, and the children meet the gnomes, and the children learn from the gnomes about the threats to the redwood, and the children convince their grandfather to not log and to join the anti-logging movement. So this book, Upton Sinclair thought it should be a movie. He asked Walt Disney if Walt Disney was interested, and he was only making cartoons at the time, but Disney promised that if he ever went to live action, he would consider this as a film. So actually it did become a film. It was filmed in the early 60s by Walt Disney and released the year before Upton Sinclair died in 1967. It's a fantastic film.
What's it called?
It's called The Gnomobile.
The Gnomobile. And
yeah.
Do you know if that's still available to be seen?
It is available.
Wow. So
Gnomobile.
Gnomobile, okay.
So, yeah, it has the children that were in Mary Poppins and... the old man that I think of being in The Real McCoys, I can't recall his name, but he was a well-known character actor at the time.
Okay, so I've gotten us out of order, I'm sorry to say, but let's get to Upton Sinclair. We've just been talking about a children's book he wrote, but we haven't...
Cal, I think this is actually a good way to start talking about Upton Sinclair.
Yeah?
Because he's so pigeonholed as the writer of The Jungle, mm-hmm. and he's so pigeonholed as a Chicago, you know, person who wrote about Chicago. So to start talking about him and about his California life is... it's kind of the way that I've approached him right from the start, you know, which is to realize that he became a Californian in 1915, and he had, you know, 50 productive years here. So I've tried to reclaim him, in a sense, or explore his California life. And one, you know, well-known aspect of it is the campaign for governor, in which he almost got elected in 1934. And a very little-known aspect, of course, is his children's book that he wrote right after the campaign. We can go back to the beginning now.
Okay, but you...
I think this was a good place to start.
Okay, but you did mention epic twice, and I'm not sure. Let's spell that out for listeners.
End poverty in California was the theme of Upton Sinclair's campaign for governor. He switched from being a socialist party member to a Democrat for this campaign. He won the Democratic primary, and he had a very ambitious program which featured many of the aspects of the New Deal and some things which the New Deal was not able to accomplish.
So many people think about California radicalism primarily in terms of the 1960s, but this is a whole another central chapter in the story that we're getting into, isn't it?
Well, the co-op movement was flourishing in California in the 30s. And he was very much in favor of co-ops. He was in favor of, you know, the unemployed taking over unused factories, farmers who were landless taking over land that wasn't being used. Millions of Californians were thrilled and inspired by this campaign. There were epic clubs all over the state. There was an epic song. There were epic rodeos. There were epic barbecues. It was a galvanizing force, and it actually reclaimed California for the Democratic Party. Until then, it had been a strictly Republican state.
And he did fairly well in the campaign, is that right?
He got 900,000 votes to 1 million for Merriam, who was the conservative Republican governor. And as some of your listeners will know, he was felled by a smear campaign run by the LA Times and by MGM and the some of the growers in the state. Hmm. They used fake newsreels that they created and put in all the movie theaters. This was the first time that this had ever happened before.
Okay, so we're kind of circling around here. We better say, Lauren, who are we talking about? Upton Sinclair.
Okay. Where does he come from?
And, you know, many of us have heard about him and The Jungle, but some of us haven't. So maybe you could give us a thumbnail early history.
Upton Sinclair said that the most significant fact of his childhood was his father's alcoholism. And I have situated him as a child of an alcoholic with a lot of the issues that children of alcoholics have. He hasn't really been understood that way before, but I want to just say straight out, that's the main thing to understand about him, is that his father was a very heavy-duty drinker, and as a result, the family bounced from one boarding house to another, constantly evicted, constantly without money. Both his parents were kind of from Southern aristocratic families who had fallen on hard times after the Civil War, but had his father not been an alcoholic, they would have been middle class. As a result of his alcoholism, they were very poor. They lived in Baltimore until he was 10 years old, and his father was a whiskey salesman, and they lived in a series of boarding houses. The family moved for more opportunities, supposedly for the father. When he was 10, they moved to New York City, and that's where Upton Sinclair grew up, and that's where he became educated, and that's where he learned about, for instance, the other version of the Civil War than what he had heard from his parents' families. So he became much more conscious as a result of going to public school in New York City and being exposed to the life of a city boy. He was, he was born in 1878, so in 1888 they landed in New York. And they lived in Manhattan, which at that time was a very poor part of New York, again, in a series of boarding houses.
And you've written about this in your first book about Sinclair. It's called The Land of Orange Groves and Jails, right?
That book was more about California than this new one.
Yeah, but there's a bit about his youth there in the book, I think.
Yeah, just a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
I had to really go back to all the sources to do this new book because I had focused on his post 1915 life in California for my first book, but this book I really had to come to terms with Baltimore and New York and their effect on his life, which was considerable.
So for a long, long time, for at least many people, the name Upton Sinclair was synonymous with the jungle. Could you say how he got to write The Jungle and maybe just a word about it before we head for California?
Sure. No, I'll probably have a lot to say. Upton Sinclair went to City College of New York, and he went to Columbia University, and he was one of those students that I kind of feel like I relate to because I was like this, who found all the classes kind of boring and realized he could educate himself a lot faster. So he read, you know, widely, taught himself a number of languages. The only teacher he really was inspired by was his music, Edward McDowell at Columbia. And McDowell encouraged him in his idea of being a poet and a writer. So first he started writing what were called hack novels, like little boys' books and stories in boys' magazines, because at that time you could actually make a living doing those kinds of stories. He wrote jokes, stories for boys. He was supporting his family by the time he was 15 or 16 with these books and these articles. But by the time he was about 20, he really wanted to write a real novel. So he gave up his life as a hack writer and went off into the woods to try to write his first novel. And at that point, he fell in love with a young woman named Mita, who came from essentially the same background as him. She had been at some of the same boarding houses. They fell in love. They got married. They had a child, had a very difficult and troubled marriage, which I think Joyce Carol Oates has characterized in her recent book, called Accursed. It's set in the year 1905, so it's right after or right as Upton Sinclair is writing The Jungle. I think it's right after he actually worked on it. So Upton Sinclair discovered socialism in 1902. It was a revelation to him that there was some way to explain all the contradictions of life that he had been observing. He was half-raised in his grandparents' and his cousins' wealthy Baltimore homes, where he was exposed to culture, books, the educated people, wealthy people. So he constantly lived what he called a Cinderella existence, going back and forth between the poor conditions of his parents and his wealthier relatives. He wanted a way to understand wealth and poverty. He wanted a way to understand inequality. He learned about socialism. He was very inspired by what he learned. He and Jack London founded the Intercollegiate Socialist Society, which aimed to educate college students in the way that he felt he had not been educated.
And was that in New York?
That was in New York, and yeah. That was in about, you know, 1903, 1904.
Yeah.
So in 1904, he sent a letter to the striking packing house workers in Chicago, telling them not to give up. They were in a what turned out to be a failed strike. And it was published in Appeal to Reason, a well-known progressive magazine. And the people who wrote Appeal to Reason invited him to write a novel about the stockyards. They were going to serialize it. They'd asked him to write a series of articles about life in the stockyards. So he moved to Chicago, and he essentially went undercover. He posed as a worker. He went to observe I don't think he actually worked, but somehow he was able to get into the factory and watch people, or maybe he just, you know, interviewed them at length. He lived with the workers, I guess is the best way to put it, not at the stockyard, but he immersed himself in that world and took voluminous notes. And out of what he heard from these Lithuanian immigrants, he wrote The Jungle. Jungle was written, published as a serial in The Appeal to Reason, and then he tried to get a publisher for it as a novel, was unable to get one. It was a very difficult struggle to get it published. He was refused by one prestigious publisher and finally found another, and there was a lot of arguments about everything, the title of the book, the content, but he did manage to get it published. And, well, you probably know the rest. You know, Roosevelt read it, the Congress read it, there was a big uproar about the condition of meat, and eventually the Food and Drug Act was passed based on the agitation that followed the publication of his book.
So this is KZYX. Our program this morning is talking about California. My name's Cal Winslow. I'm your host, and I'm happy to be talking with the author, Professor Lauren Coodley, who's written two books, or one book and one just about to come out, about the muckraker, Upton Sinclair, who became a Californian. But just before we get to California, so he, Lauren, he was catapulted then into this very heady world of the muckrakers, Lincoln Steffens, Ida Tarbell, the history of Standard Oil, the bohemian sort of renaissance of Greenwich Village and all. That must have had a big impact on him.
Yeah, it did. He, you know, remember, he felt very strongly about alcoholism, and he was kind of heartbroken to see that alcohol was destroying the lives of many of his friends. He himself went to Battle Creek Sanitarium, where William Kellogg was trying to educate people in new ways to eat. He was fascinated with the question of what would really nourish people, what would keep people from getting sick. So he wrote a book called Good Health and How We Want It in 1908, and then he founded a utopian commune based on really on the ideas of Charlotte Perkins Gilman after he had this success from The Jungle. In, I think it was 1909, he founded Helican Hall, which was a, as they say, it's a utopian commune in New Jersey, where writers and artists could come to live and share their ideas, and there was collective child care, although it was done only by the women, but the women all watched each other's kids, which was a huge big deal. And there was collective housework. That is, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who was a socialist theorist from the turn of the century, had argued that it didn't make sense for every woman to slave alone in her own kitchen, that it made much more sense to feed a number of people from one, you know, collective kitchen where, you know, people would be compensated for their work and women wouldn't have to be slaves in their own household. So Upton Sinclair was extremely taken with this idea after having, you know, lived in a nuclear family with his wife and child, and it had been very, very difficult for all of them. So he founded this commune, plunged most of the money from The Jungle into this commune. I think it was $30,000 at the time. And it lasted about a year. It was very, very successful. It was burned in a mysterious arson fire. And he felt like he had lost, you know, he had glimpsed the future. It had been a wonderful, wonderful vision. And for years afterwards, he tried to replicate it by going to visit other utopian communes in the East Coast and in Carmel, actually. That's actually what got him out to California, was to come investigate Carmel in about 1912.
So he comes to California. So let's get to, then we're getting closer to the main point, and which is your new book. But why does he come to California then?
His marriage was not a success. His wife was unfaithful, and he himself had fallen in love with another woman, although they never officially got together. He had a love affair with Inez Mulholland, who's should be better known, but she's a suffragist and labor agitator who was the only person to die campaigning for suffrage. She collapsed actually in California during the suffrage campaign of 1912. She had been really, I think, the big love of Upton Sinclair's life. So I investigated this relationship and wrote about it in my book. But by 1912, she was gone. He got out of his marriage. It was difficult. He had to go to Europe to get a divorce. And he came to California to see what this, you know, ostensibly to see what was going on in Carmel. He was very good friends with Gaylord Wilshire, who was a socialist who had founded a mine in Bishop based on communal principles, and who had a newspaper called Wilshire's. And it was just an adventure for Sinclair, I would say. He wrote some plays while he was in Carmel. I'm sorry, he actually was in Carmel in 1909, I'm remembering. It was a little bit earlier than what I said.
Okay, so he's bitten, he stays?
He's here for about a summer, I would say. George Sterling became one of his best friends, who was running everything in Carmel in those days, a poet. He came back to the East and resolved the marriage by having to go, as I said, to Europe and living there in order to get a divorce. So he came back from Europe in about 1912 with the divorce, met and married Mary Craig. So he was with his second wife by the time he moved to California in 1915. In 1913, he and Mary Craig did something that I think is quite noteworthy in New York, if you'll allow me to speak about that before we get to California.
Sure, whatever you like, please.
Okay. So in 1913, the Ludlow Massacre took place in the Colorado coal fields. There was a lot of uproar and concern about it among the liberals and progressive people of New York, as there is now whenever there's a terrible strike with horrible consequences for the workers. There was a big event in Madison Square Garden where the strikers came and talked about what had been done to them. As you probably know, they were burned and fired upon by the equivalent of the National Guard at that time. So Sinclair and his wife lay in bed talking about what to do. They had just gotten married. He had remarried a Southern woman who would be his major companion for the next 50 years. And Sinclair said we should picket the Rockefeller headquarters in New York. And no one had ever picketed the corporate headquarters before. Picketing had always been done at the site of the strike. But Sinclair said, well, the Rockefellers own the mine. We should hold them responsible publicly in New York. We should have mourning pickets, meaning everybody's going to wear a black band around their arm, and we're going to, you know, have a presence in front of Rockefeller headquarters. And he said, and because it's me, all the newspaper reporters are going to come because I'm famous, so I'm going to use my fame and my celebrity to draw attention to this issue. So I think this is just remarkable. He essentially invented not only the undercover reporting of the jungle, but then essentially corporate picketing, which now is something that, you know, is very common, but then no one had ever thought of. So this lasted for a few months with all kinds of people showing up, and even though the Ludlow strike was defeated, the idea of, you know, going to the corporate headquarters, I think, was, you know, a brilliant and important one.
Okay, and well, maybe before you took us back to New York, readers might want to know a series of other books. I'm looking at a list here, The Money Changers, The Fasting Cure. I think I have a copy of The Cry for Justice on my shelf. And then The Brass Check.
Those were Cry for Justice, and it was the first book he wrote in California, and then The Brass Check was a later book in California.
Oh, so that's when he's out in California. Okay, so he's quite a prolific writer, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he wrote about 80 works, novels, plays, mostly novels and plays, a science fiction story that became a play, of course, a lot of nonfiction writing. The Brass Check was nonfiction. He had a whole series called the Dead Hand series, which was aimed to show the effect of capitalism in various institutions like religion, like the press, like the education system. So, yes, he has an astonishing... He was very productive. I mean, one of the points I make is that because he was interested in health, diet, wellness, temperance, he figured out how to have a very productive life that didn't include, you know, boozing and didn't include non-monogamy or, you know, trying to seduce the women that he knew. He was quite the opposite. He was had a lot of integrity in his personal life, and that made him, I think, have a huge circle of friends, but perhaps more importantly for his work, it made him able to concentrate on his work and be very productive.
Okay, so you have written a new biography.
Yes.
It's called Upton Sinclair: A Life. And it's being published by Nebraska, is that right? University of Nebraska?
Yes. The title is Upton Sinclair, California Socialist Celebrity Intellectual.
Okay.
That's the actual title at this point.
So tell us about, that's a big undertaking. How did you, how and why did you decide that you were going to do that?
Well, when I initially wrote about Upton Sinclair in the 90s, for my master's thesis, I wrote about why there should be a new biography. There hadn't been one at that point since 1976. And I thought that current thinking in history would allow us to reevaluate Upton Sinclair from a more contemporary perspective than had been done by his original biographers right after he died. He died in 68, by the way. So originally I wrote my book, my master's thesis, and because I had to work full-time and was raising children, I was not able to expand my master's thesis into a book at that time. Then in 2006, there were finally two biographies that were written by two other gentlemen to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the Jungle. Both of them were excellent in their own ways, but I still felt that my own perspective had a different spin, a different take, that I still, there was something to offer that I had that wasn't in these two new biographies of 2006. So when I retired, I started working on a biography of Upton Sinclair, and after a number of years of working on it, it is now finally being published.
So you're being modest. Tell us what were the new points that you thought could be made, or what was the new perspective that you felt was you could bring, or might be lacking in the older ones?
Well, I would say there's probably about three points. I didn't feel that his advocacy for labor had been adequately understood or emphasized by previous biographers. And I thought that that was very important. I myself have been involved in supporting organized labor, and I understand the role of, you know, a sympathetic public. I understand what the Women's Trade Union League did to support women who were striking in early New York City. And so I felt that his role and his integral role related to various labor actions had not really been adequately explored. That was one part. The other part was that his relationship to temperance and being a non-drinker had been completely misunderstood and ridiculed by, I would say, all biographers. And there had been a certain lack of understanding of the effects of alcoholism on a family and on a child that, well, I've not only known a lot of alcoholics and seen what's happened, but, you know, I've taught a lot of students who've had alcoholism destroy their own families. So felt that I had, and I also was aware of the temperance movement and the way that it's been caricatured and misunderstood. So, I had this background in some of the things that women's history has developed as part of its historiography, as part of its development as a field. And the third piece that I had was the centrality of support networks that female activists had among themselves, people like Jane Addams, Helen Keller, Margaret Sanger. Well, it turned out that all of these women were good friends with Upton Sinclair and had corresponded with him and were very supported by him. I mean, really, he had deep friendships with many, many activist women of the 20th century. So I wanted to include the correspondence that I found at the Lilly Library, which is where his papers are. When I was able to do research there, I wanted to document his friendships with women and talk about a little bit about what it meant for them to have somebody who was, as Margaret Sanger might have put it, in their corner. Really, really a big, solid ally. So my book actually includes an appendix of all the women that he was friends with sources on how to read more about these women.
Well, here's, how about this? Could we just go through those points? Is that all right with you? And
we'll
start off with maybe you could tell us a little bit about the way labor fits in, and then we'll move to temperance and then to women's history and women's supporters. Does that sound all right?
Yeah.
Well, how about let's start with labor then.
Yeah. So I mentioned the first, the first situation is, of course, the packing house workers in the jungle. He said, "I aim for their hearts, but I hit their stomachs," about his reading public. He really wanted to awaken people to the horrible situation of immigrant workers in slaughterhouses. But what most people got out of the book is that their food was toxic and that, you know, they needed to have more protection for their food. Well, I can't even begin to say how relevant those topics are today. Immigrant workers in slaughterhouses is an ongoing scandal, and of course the condition of our food and whether it's safe or not is an ongoing, I wouldn't say, if it's not a scandal, it's at least a crisis. So he's very current for what we're looking at today, but that was his initial effort on behalf of workers was the jungle. The second was the picketing of corporate headquarters of Rockefeller. And the third was in 1924 when he became involved with the longshoremen in San Pedro who were on strike. They were trying to organize the West Coast ports as part of the effort that was eventually successful in 34 in San Francisco. So Upton Sinclair inserted himself into this controversial strike in San Pedro, and he marched up this hill called Liberty Hill that the strikers had taken over, and he read the Bill of Rights and was arrested for reading the Bill of Rights to the strikers. It was quite a big scandal in Los Angeles and probably all over the country. He was held incommunicado for several days. His wife was afraid that he might be killed in jail. Eventually, he got out and wrote a letter daring the Los Angeles police chief to come after him, taking on the Merchants Association, which was responsible for the strike. He wrote a play called Singing Jailbirds, which is about all the IWW guys who were locked up in jail for free speech issues. He was very involved in the IWW, not a member, but as a sympathizer and a publicist. He lent his celebrity very consciously to all kinds of important causes.
Maybe you could say just a couple of definitional points. Now, he wasn't IWW. What was that? Was he in the Socialist Party, but he was in the Democratic Party as a candidate? How would you could you pigeonhole him at all? Could you tell us what were his politics?
He was a member of the Socialist Party in the early 20th century, which was, as you know, perhaps a thriving party. Eugene Debs got millions of votes as a representative of that party. It had its heyday in the early 20th century. He split with the Socialist Party, interestingly, over World War I, which he supported. He regretted that later. He wrote a book about how he had been wrong, but he left the Socialist Party over World War I. He was a sympathizer to the IWW, but not a member, because he earned his living as a writer, and writers were not in the IWW as members. He switched from the Socialist Party to the Democratic Party in 1934 in order to run for governor of California. And I would say his politics were somewhat more radical than FDR, but he was very comfortable in the Democratic Party and stayed in the Democratic Party through the end of his life, which would be the presidency of Lyndon Johnson. He was a huge supporter of Lyndon Johnson. And because of the changes, you know, the Great Society and the things that Lyndon Johnson brought in domestically.
Okay, thank you. So, our time is going by. This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow, your host this morning, talking about California as our program. We're very lucky to be talking to Professor Lauren Coodley, who's discussing her new book, her forthcoming book from the University of Nebraska, a biography of the muckraker and California socialist and activist Upton Sinclair. So the second point, so labor, the second point you thought you were bringing something new to was the issue of temperance. And again, looking through my notes, I have to notice this, Carrie McWilliams, another California writing, for Southern California, the decade was a long drunken orgy, one protracted debauch. And Upton Sinclair came as an immigrant to California in 1915, settled amidst this drunken orgy. Maybe that's an introduction to you.
Yeah.
You say that he was interested in temperance, I suppose, socially as well as personally.
That's correct. He never drank his whole life. But I think his interest in temperance was part of a larger interest in health and wellness and nutrition, which is why I asked John Robbins, the founder, in a way, of the whole food movement, to write a review of the book, because I felt that the food movement as we have it today is has some very, very similar philosophies and perspectives that Upton Sinclair espoused. And specifically, Upton Sinclair felt that knowledge of healthy eating should not be confined to the elite, that poor people, working class people, should know just as much about what would nourish them and have access to it as more educated or privileged people. So if he had his way, the same kind of food that's eaten by, you know, organic, you know, artisan, all of that would be, you know, on the tables of poor families. You know, he really, really wanted to share what he had learned from his own study of diet and nutrition with his working class readers. It was very, very important to him. So he wrote something called The Book of Life in 1920 to try to teach some of what he had learned.
And the temperance movement.
And the temperance movement, he marched in temperance parades with his mother, and he was followed. He wrote a book called The Wet Parade, I should say. That was the book that he wrote about alcoholism. He wrote two books. He wrote the Cup of Fury in the 50s and the Wet Parade in 1930. The Wet Parade was made into a film, which is still available, a fantastic film with Jimmy Durante. And the Wet Parade was about the history of Prohibition, but it was told differently, not how Prohibition was a big mistake, but how Prohibition was a noble experiment. And so it was the story of what had happened to Prohibition, how it had been underfunded, prosecuted, shall we say. And his hero in the book is a Prohibition agent and his wife, both children of alcoholics, who are determined to get rid of alcohol and alcoholism, which, you know, if we had no alcohol or alcoholism in our society, we'd be ever so much better. I think it was a noble experiment. I completely agree with him. So that was kind of his last. Oh, then he wrote The Cup of Fury in the 50s, about a very sad book about all his friends and colleagues and the people he admired who had died too young of alcoholism.
Okay, so what what are your perspectives that in this book, it's labor one, temperance and the importance of temperance two. And I think we have some time left, so let's talk about number three. I think you feel like you have brought some insights into the question of Sinclair, but also much more broadly, women writers, women activists, women's networks. Do you want to introduce us to that aspect of your...
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Let me start with the idea, should there be feminist biographies of men? What would a feminist biography of a man look like? I took that as a challenge, that idea, that a feminist perspective could and should be brought into biographies not only of women but of men. So what does a feminist perspective mean? Well, we used to say the personal is the political or the political is the personal. I think that's a kind of problematic now. There's a lot of ways to critique that perspective. But what I took from it is, let's look at Sinclair's personal life, but let's look at it with new eyes. Let's look at it with eyes that understand the importance of monogamy, that understand the importance of friendship, of comradely support. You know, the main issue that founded women's liberation was women's sense of betrayal by the men in their lives in the New Left, in the civil rights, and in the anti-war movements. Women's sense that they were just being relegated, they were being, ignored, not valued, etc. So what's really important is to understand that the feminists of the early 20th century also had that critique and also asked men to be different, and some men agreed to be different, and explored ways to have a more egalitarian relationship with women. So Sinclair was part of that movement. He was not by any means the only person to participate in the, should we say, male feminism. But I think that most of the men that participated in that movement, not that many of them have had books about them. So when I had the opportunity to write this book, I wanted to include Sinclair's feminism, which I think primarily manifested itself in a tremendous amount of support for the work of women, artists, writers, and activists. And as I said, I have created a appendix of the women who were Upton Sinclair's friends and correspondents. If I could share some of those names with you.
And tell us a bit about them.
Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who was a socialist feminist, wrote a lot of utopian novels and practical economics about how women should live differently, how men and women should live differently. As I said, he founded his commune based on her ideas. Jade Adams. He met her through his research into the Chicago slums and, of course, participated in the life at Hull House. Margaret Sanger, he wrote letters to try to get her out of jail. They corresponded throughout their lives. Edith Summers Kelly, who wrote the one novel, Weeds, which is considered a feminist masterpiece. He got Weeds translated into a number of languages and wrote letters of support to her. Ella Reeve Bloor, who was a colleague, she was a radical activist. She helped him in many of his investigations of child labor. They corresponded. Inez Milholland, suffragist, he was in love with, although they did not really have a formal relationship. Well, he was married at the time, and she was involved with someone else, so it was just, it was a brief thing, but it was very important to both of them. Susan Glaspell, a novelist whose work he reviewed. Mary Beard, one of the founders of Women's History, with whom he corresponded in the 30s. Alice Stone Blackwell, the daughter of two of the major 19th century suffragists, a friend throughout both their lives, who corresponded with him. Miriam Allen DeFord, a science fiction writer and journalist, another correspondent. Agnes Smedley, who wrote about China and the fantastic novel Daughter of Earth, again, whom he corresponded with. Vera Brittain, who wrote Testament of Youth, anti-war novel in Britain, another very close friend who came to visit him and whom he visited. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, radical agitator, whom he corresponded with. Does that give you enough idea? Well, there's quite a few.
Sure, but
Helen Keller as well.
And Helen Keller, and we can read about the relationships and all of these women in the book and in the appendix. Is that?
Yes.
Yeah. And so why? Let's go back again. This is quite a list of people. What was it about him again that do you think enabled him to do this? And what did the women like about him, maybe?
Well, you know, I kind of think it's what women say about gay men, that they feel like they're friends with them without feeling that they're you know, going to be sexually objectified or seduced and abandoned. I mean, I think women look for male allies and colleagues and friends and, you know, sometimes are disappointed in that search. He chose to be in a monogamous marriage. He, you know, his detractors say, well, he wasn't very sexual. I think I've found evidence to the contrary, but I think, like many people today who are in successful monogamous marriages, he didn't, you know, violate his marriage vows, and in that way, he and his wife were able to be friends with, you know, a huge range of people that included, you know, George Bernard Shaw, Albert Einstein, Mahatma Gandhi, and, you know, many, many others. I write about his male friends as well. So I think his friendships are kind of extraordinary, and as I said, they haven't really been noted by his biographers. It's part of the insight of women's history is to look at these friendship networks, for instance, those that Eleanor Roosevelt had with her network of New Deal activists.
Okay, and maybe, and we've got a few minutes left now, maybe let's put him back in California. And is there anything you'd want to say about his life? And he lived in Southern California. He was a tennis player.
He seemed to. I wanted to say what he did in the 40s.
He had some upper.
Because I haven't gotten to that.
Oh, okay. And he had some upper class friends as well.
Yeah. He was initially good friends with Henry Ford. I was going to say, as part of his labor activism, he wrote The Flivver King, which was used to help organize auto workers in the 30s. But in the 40s, during World War II, he wrote a series of novels called the Lanny Budd series, or the World End series, one of which got him a Pulitzer Prize. But these are novels that people used, were inspired by in the 40s and read in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s to explain the rise of Nazism and of fascism in Europe, and to they were kind of like adventure stories about an American young man who grows up in Europe and becomes involved in the anti-Nazi fight. They were beautifully done, beautifully researched. They were bestsellers. They were in every train station. They were they introduced him to a whole new generation of readers in the 40s, because you remember his first readers were like in 1906. So here's people in the 40s who are just crazy about the Lanny Budd series. And that was his last big successful production, was the Lanny Budd series. There were 11 books. The last one was set in, I think, 1950.
Would it be possible to read one of those today?
Yes.
They're
all available.
They're all in print.
Yes, I highly recommend reading them in order. The first one is called World's End.
Okay. How could he be friends with Henry Ford and some of his other... Was he friends with Walt Disney?
He wasn't really friends with Walt Disney. Henry Ford was kind of different when they were friends. You know, this was in 1916, 1917. Henry Ford was a little more utopian. You know, he was a huge activist for against World War One. That's probably not very well known. But he was much more idealistic and socially responsible in his early years than he became later on. So they would not have been friends in the 30s.
Okay.
And that's when Sinclair wrote Flivver Cling, which was a very critical picture of Henry Ford.
And maybe we could come back then. We were talking about Epic at the very beginning of the of our program. We've got poverty today, plenty of it in California. Maybe tell us again a bit about what Epic stood for, what his ideas were, and whether you think any of them are relevant.
many of the things that he advocated in EPIC were put into effect by Roosevelt with the New Deal alphabet soup programs, whether it was the CCC, PWA, WPA, with, you know, which our friend Gray Brecken is brilliantly documenting in the Living New Deal project. So I think other ideas that he talked about were things like Social Security, which we thought we had until recently. I'm not sure if we're still going to have it. But many of the ideas of, you know, the New Deal were what he talked about. And so the more radical aspects of his program, like the unemployed taking over, you know, empty factories, or the landless taking over available land, you know, some of those things have happened in other countries. A few of them have happened here. They're, you know, more on the radical end of social activism. But certainly they've happened. I mean, we had a Republic factory, I think it was in Illinois, that was taken over by workers a few years ago. And I know there's been factories in Argentina and other places where workers have taken them. I think that his ideas, some of them have already come true. Some of them are no longer radical. He invented the idea of scrip, which is now used in school programs. Co-ops, which were, you know, a huge success for many, many years and still thrive in some communities. But I think, you know, perhaps more profoundly, his idea of ending poverty, you know, what would it take to end poverty? And, you know, a social welfare state can reduce poverty enormously if it taxes the rich appropriately, if it establishes minimum wage. There are ways to reduce poverty, and obviously we need to address those and think about them.
He died. His son, you quote his son David, which is kind of a moving end to maybe our discussion, recalling his father. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
What was that?
Well, I don't remember the exact words, but I know he was very proud of what his father had achieved. You know, when you buy a piece of beef, you can thank Upton Sinclair for it. That whole thing, when you look at the success of the auto workers union, he helped found the ACLU. When you think about civil liberties, you can thank Upton Sinclair. Yeah, his son was very clear that he had devoted his life to social activism, and he used means of reaching readers. So I think he's been, although he was a very talented writer, he really wanted to write for a purpose rather than just for art's sake. And he has been much criticized for that and made fun of and misunderstood. But I think social activists understand what he was trying to do.
We didn't get to that. Maybe just a quick word on what misunderstood, how, why, what ridiculed. I don't actually know.
Well, there's an idea among some critics and literary people that work should exist in and of itself. It should have no relationship to politics. The author shouldn't have an agenda. The author shouldn't be trying to convince you of anything. Sometimes Hemingway or Faulkner are held up as, you know, they're far better writers because they never thought about trying to push an agenda. You know, Upton Sinclair just basically thought the agenda was more important than the writing. He really was a passionate believer in social justice, and all his work was aimed at educating and informing not only American readers, but really the world public about what he saw as the truth of what was happening in the world, and also the history.
And I guess I hear you saying you'd like people to get that from your book.
Yeah, I would.
If you don't mind, Lauren, I have your notes in front of me. I'm lucky. His son David. Can I read this out?
Yeah, please.
His son David. My father used to say, I don't know if anyone will care to examine my heart after I die, but if they do, they will find two words there, social justice. That would be something for any father to hear his son say, wouldn't it?
Yes.
We've been talking this morning to Professor Lauren Coodley and talking particularly about two of her books. The first one Heyday Press, The Land of Orange Groves and Jails, and the second one to come out. Is it this fall, Lauren?
Yeah, in September.
In September. A full biography of Upton Sinclair, the muckraker, California socialist, champion of social justice. Lauren, thank you very much for coming on the program.
It was a pleasure speaking with you, Cal.
And
thank you for asking me.
No, it's our pleasure. And listeners, this is Talking About California. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back next Thursday at the same time. Good morning.